The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial. Welcome back to Millennial 2023. This is the ninth night, I believe. Yes, it is. And there are four streams. Later on, History Bro, and then Lady of Shalott, and then Apollonian Jam. But right now, it's Survive the Jive. Tom Roussel, welcome back to Millennial. I think you've been on almost every year.
I wish I could say I had a 9-year streak, but I did. I think I missed at least 1 year. I can't remember which year it was, but yeah, 9 is the magic number.
We should try to do a reenactment so that it's as if you were on that year and we can talk about the stuff that happened that year.
I have to airbrush out some of my wrinkles.
That's been an unbroken record. Well, so this has been another year of academia. What would you say? Blackwashing, brownwashing Britain's history. This is a big deal. It seems to be an ongoing thing. I'm guessing at this point that academia is—it's not even white people or guilty middle class liberals doing this. It's now non-white people themselves at this point. There do seem to be quite a few of those in the history sector. It's a mixture. And it seems to be an ongoing attack on, British identity, English identity, and Anglo-Saxon. Of course, Anglo-Saxon itself, the concept, was under attack. I think, we talked about it last year.
Yeah.
I think it's and continued it's got, this.
Yeah, I mean, we can start off with that because although, you know, I've been in this long battle since 2019 with these people about battling Anglo-Saxon. As we discussed last year, I won't go over too much of it because we did it already. And I also did a traditional Britain group speech about it last Christmas or the Christmas before about that. And basically, like, it was spearheaded by a medievalist of color, you could call her, Mary Rambrun-Olm, who said she wants to destroy medieval studies. And she said she's angry that medievalists read foreign languages instead of studying Marxism. And when asked what the two most important authors for students of medieval English history should read, she listed two black Marxist race Marxists who aren't even historians, don't even talk about medieval England, don't even know about medieval England. It just tells you she's the one who was spearheading the ban Anglo-Saxon thing in 2019. And her friend, who is a white homosexual American living in Germany, the two of them together have been sort of the big face of that. But like last year, I was thinking, you know, that there was like a kind of pushback on them. But this year, since then, we've had, 2022, they published in the Yearbook of English Studies an attack on me, Mary Rambrun-Olm and Eric Wade. And they called me, said I was in the National Front or something. They made that up. And there were also another thing. I can't remember. Yeah. June this year, probably a victory for them, for their side, or because it wasn't them directly, I can tell. But Cambridge's Anglo-Saxon, Norse and Celtic Studies Department now claims Anglo-Saxons are not a distinct ethnic group. And they seek to remove the term and to be more as a quote anti-racist. But on the plus side, unlike in 2019, when these people started this thing and it was just an obscure academic thing, I was one of the only people my stream on YouTube was one of the first pushbacks and unfollowed some academics, made some pushback afterwards. And then later you did get some media, but this time in June, straight off the bat, you have mainstream media actually, like all the tabloids and the broadsheets, criticizing Cambridge for this. So, okay, I'd say that we're seeing that people like these race Marxists, like Mary Rambranom, have successfully, over the course of 4 years, influenced academic power to the extent that they're now, Cambridge is willing to, you know, repeat some of the things in 2023 that were a little bit more rare back in 2019. But on the other side, the media is much more likely now to repeat some of the things I was saying in 2019. So there has been some positive change in terms of overall consensus that this stuff's crazy, even though I don't think we're making much headway within institutions, academic institutions.
Yeah, it seems like they are sort of determined to go in this direction, regardless of the evidence, regardless of the truth. It's an ideological thing. And the fact that she recommended two Marxist books instead of two medieval history books is indicative of this. It's the ideology that matters, not the actual reality. I would say that's how it seems, that there ideologues tend to be like that. I mean, that's the stereotype of someone whose worldview is informed by theory and often wishful thinking, because it would be it would be convenient for them if British history were dissolved, were discredited, and so on.
By the way, I just found that there were Kim, for those interested who they were, Kim Hall and Margot Hendricks are the two authors she recommended for anyone studying English medieval history. You can look them up and see what they have to do with English medieval history. But yeah, sorry, you were going to say.
Yeah, well, it just seems to be incredibly ideological at this point. I mean, I think the pretense that they're trying to uncover the actual truth is becoming, is falling away. I remember that the Doctor Who showrunner said in 2016 that we're going to, we'll travel to the Middle Ages and so on, historical periods, and we'll show black people there who wouldn't have been there. But we'll bring forth this better world by showing it on screen. We'll sort of conjure it.
Yeah. That's a sentiment that Mary Rambranom has expressed, and Eric Wade. Mary Rambranom said, I quote, "We pick and choose what's anachronistic." And Eric Wade said, "Lord of the Rings, Game of Thrones, and Vikings perpetuate white masculine narratives which are not reflective of the medieval period." So, like, the kind of things that these people in the BBC are saying are things that there are people in academia. Now, admittedly, these two people aren't like representative of typical medieval historians. They're pretty extreme, but they have enough power to change, to influence. I mean, we can't be sure that Cambridge was directly influenced by them, but I think they were, and that things seem to be going that direction. So there's a kind of feeling that what's true is, you know, a postmodern perspective enough, we can say that's flexible. We pick and choose what's anachronistic. So yeah, maybe there weren't that many blacks, but that's not the point. The point is that blacks have suffered from, you know, institutional prejudices, and then this needs to be corrected by constructing a new version of the past, which will, you know, remedy these inequalities or whatever they're thinking, some kind of justification like that for lying.
So the past is a sort of utility for the present. The past is something that we need it to be the way we need it to be.
Well, she said exactly that, like dismantling, another quote from her, "Dismantling the system means changing the way our field, medieval studies, is structured. And that means essentially burning it down. It's something people are not prepared to do because they're too busy studying Old English, Old Norse, Old Irish, whatever. Those languages have saved absolutely zero people in our present day." She's saying the entire study of medieval history has the utilitarian purpose of saving people from what, and what people, you can infer from her politics. But it's a completely different idea of what history is from what's conventionally understood in academia.
Yeah, it's quite incredible. But I mean, I know that they could say, well, history has always been like this. We have always used the past to bolster the present and reinforce the ideas of the present. So
that's true.
I understand that, and that is true. But But the thing is, it has been our history that we did that with, especially in the context of Britain. This is them co-opting and distorting in a very willful and overt and extreme manner the history of the British Isles. And I think it's important because the conservative and right-wing response to this kind of thing has always been in our lifetimes to laugh it off. And, oh, those crazy lefties, look what they're doing this week kind of thing. And I think it's crucial that we don't have that attitude because this is very, very serious.
Back in 2019, we did that first stream about ban Anglo-Saxon. Loads of people were like, just ignore the people, just ignore the idiots. Like, and I was trying to... I really thought they're so stupid. You don't understand how academia leads the entire sort of narrative of and like culture of the culture-bearing stratum. That includes people who work in law, people who work in politics, people who work in media, people who basically dictate what your society is. That all starts off in academia. So if you know, there's a reason why the left aimed for those institutions first. They're not stupid in that way. And I think a lot of right-wing people are stupid, to be honest, the way they think that you can laugh it off. You absolutely shouldn't laugh it off. And that's why I directed the final part of that stream back in 2019 to, I was specifically talking to academics saying, even if you're a lefty and you're a white lefty, but you like Anglo-Saxon studies, you have to speak out against this because your job is going to be gone within a few years if you don't, because they'll find a way to get rid of it because it's not relevant to their cause. So even if, and I know, because I know like some very good, very like, you know, reputable and talented historians are Marxists, but they're not like this kind of crazy race Marxist. They're just like, they still want to actually study history as it is. They just happen to believe in the nonsense of Marxism. But that's another matter. I'm trying to explain to them, like even them, you have to oppose this too. It's not just, you know, people who believe in the self-determination of European ethnic groups. Although anyone morally sound will believe in that. But anyone who wants, if you want to work in academia and not be a part of this like crazy cultural push, then you need to oppose it. But hopefully that'll happen. That's another thing I don't like about what people who speak the way you just described is when people say that right-wingers shouldn't go into academia. Because, I mean, on the one hand, I say, okay, I understand that actually, especially... It feels like in the humanities like history, it's going to be hard for you to earn a living. It's very competitive and there's not much money in the jobs that are available. And I do think like a good thing for people, you know, native people now is to get money, find a job that you can get money because you're going to need it coming up. But at the same time, we need people in the institutions. We need people in there on our side speaking for truth. So I really think it's very short-sighted to say like, oh, everyone can, you know, learn, get an education in the university of life because we want people in Oxford and Cambridge.
I mean, it depends what your goals are. Obviously, an academic a degree is not nearly as useful as a lot of people say it is. I mean, the whole Blair revolution, get everyone into university, and I think it's 1 in 3 or 1 in 2 now who go to university. It's obviously ridiculous. Mm-hmm. From that point of view, yeah, you don't need it. And also from another point of view, I mean, obviously I'm capable of an academic education, but I think it would actually have been better for me if I'd just gone straight into the world of work. I think that would have actually been a healthier life path for me, speaking personally, and probably a lot of other people. But nonetheless... A completely separate concern from that, from your own personal life course, is that we need the academia to have some right wingers in it, or conservatives, or whatever you want to call it, because otherwise it will simply be colonized by the left, and really has been already to a great extent. So, irrespective of whether it would be good for you personally, that's a whole other thing. It needs to be there. We need to be in there so as to fight the battle on that ground, on that territory. Otherwise, we're simply ceding that ground to them. And it's extremely important ground, as you said. So again, yeah. I think right-wingers just tend to not understand. And I don't know why this is, because you'd think that it's common sense, but they don't seem to understand how things actually work a lot of the time. Like, if you're not in academia, academia will be occupied by your enemies. It's as simple as that. And you can say, well, it doesn't matter because academia doesn't matter. But then that's another stupid statement. Academia clearly does matter.
Yes. And the same with law as well. I think, you know, we need lawyers or judges. I mean, think about what's happening in America when there's a, you know, you end up, which judge you end up in front of makes all the difference to people's lives. So it's like, these are important things in all, I'm not just talking about Britain and America and other countries too. Like, that is essential. And power isn't just politics. Power isn't just, I mean, the meta-political battle everyone's been saying is important. And I agree, that's true too. But meta-politics actually involves institutions of power that are non-political, like the media and the academia. So, like, to have power in metapolitics, you need to have at least some voice. And the less and less power we have, the more easy it is for power to be taken away from us. And that's what we're seeing. Like, you know, smaller publishing companies like Arctos being completely removed from things, and like it's not just them, but many others, wasn't it? Now there's even one this year, because only, you know, like small publishing companies have ever published, for example, Julius Evola. I know Arctos published quite a lot. I think Countercurrents might have done something by him. But besides them, the only one that published anything isn't a right-wing publisher. It's an esoteric, like mystical, like stuff publisher called Inner Traditions. And they don't publish any right-wing content. They just happen to do some Evola because Evola is an esotericist. And now even they're being threatened of being canceled just for having, I mean, it's like a tiny proportion of their output. Like they publish all sorts of like Wicca wishy-washy stuff too, whatever you like. But it's very, they're not a big publisher. And it's probably, some person's perspective, easier just to squash them like a bug, just to remove the inconvenience of having any publishers publishing any books. And like, this is why you can't fight a battle from, you don't want to fight a battle from the bottom of the hill. You want to take the high ground as much as possible. And that's like quite obvious strategy. Like the idea of like willingly ceding the ground of academia just makes no sense at all.
No, it's retarded. It's simply retarded. The way that they would, I'm guessing they would do that with that small publisher is publishing Evola isn't enough to get you debanked. You're not going to persuade a bank to cut them off or a payment processor, but you could persuade, well, I don't want to give them ideas, but their peers to dissociate from that company because it, you know, looks like it's right wing. And that's how I think it would happen. And then they would move on to further, harsher measures. I mean, this is why you want to be occupying as many places in society as possible. It really is as simple as that. Our enemies have done this. It has worked very well for them. That means we should do the same thing, if we can. I mean, if it's just entirely against our mentality, then maybe not. But otherwise, copy the tactics that have been proven to work. And certainly, to do anything at all, you need to be in the place where you can do it. I couldn't agree more. And I think there's another motivation here that we should be sympathetic to, which is that, well, academia isn't our place anymore. It's been completely subverted. So we would just be grinding metal, trying to operate in that environment. Do you think that's true? Well, yeah, they did it. Yeah, but they did it up against naive conservatives who had no idea what was going on. I think that's the argument there. Whereas the lefties today are hyper aware of the possibility of subversion. So I think that is the argument. And I think it's true. But again, that doesn't mean we shouldn't be there at all.
I can say this. I have been in the last two or three years, invited to speak at three major universities by the student bodies. Two of them was secret. Major universities. But one of them this year I spoke at, it was a public event, Exeter University, and like 50 odd students showed up for it. And all very positive, excellent, very intelligent young men and women. I was very heartened to see that. And there was no counter protest, nothing like that. It was just a lot of young people just wanting to have a discussion about some of the things we're talking about now. These people don't have any intention of ceding ground in academia. This is the future. So I'm not black-pilled on that, actually. I do think that there are plenty of people, young people. I think the difference is because when I was a student, I mean, not especially when I was doing my undergraduate, there was no sense of urgency for native British people to like care about this stuff. I think now, it's not propaganda. It's not necessary for propaganda of any kind to really convince people, because they're being convinced by reality, like just the circumstances of life in modern Britain, that it is now necessary for people to take some kind of action to try and undo what the left has done to this country.
Yeah, I think so. It's undeniable. I think in the late 2000s, it wasn't as obvious as it is now. It was like life wasn't as I'll just put it that way. it wasn't as grim as it is now. So I think a lot of young people today far more are picking up on the situation than were 15 years ago or so, and that's. It's, on the one hand, it's both good and bad. But yeah, I think this is an area that we really should be encouraging each other to go in for this. Another part of it, I think, is that right-wingers tend not to be social in the same way that the left are. That's a whole thing. It's a whole conversation, really. I think the left are more given to a more female approach and a more collaborative approach, whereas conservatives, right-wingers tend to be more the autist, working on his own. So there's that. That's another thing there. But again, you're not going to take over society that way. And that is ultimately what we want to do. We want to influence the discourse. Not take over society, but influence the discourse in the way that our opponents are currently doing. I mean, it's a perfectly reasonable thing to want to do. So, yeah, but I should clarify. Take over society is not the correct thing. I simply mean colonize in the same way that they have colonized. At any rate, there needs to be a mix of voices. To have this ideological purity that seems to be reigning in academia now is clearly not healthy.
And this, but for non-British viewers, I always focus on Britain because we're British, but of course the same exact thing applies everywhere else as well.
Oh, certainly. Are there any other? I wanted to. You mentioned before we went on air about various things that have happened this year. Would you like to go through those? Because is one thing, but yeah, go on.
I mean, the Anglo-Saxon thing is the old ongoing thing now for 2019, but there's also another old ongoing thing of, as you called it earlier, blackwashing, which is weird because, why is it always black? It's like, why don't they try and insert, we have a huge Chinese community, we have a huge Polish community, we have all kinds of immigrants. London has, for example, more languages spoken than any other city on the entire planet. And it's not like they're actually trying to, it's not just that they want to promote diversity. They're not trying to insert all these different ethnicities into our past. They specifically want sub-Saharan Africans to be there. I don't know why, but my own theory, which is not proven, it's speculative, but it's my own theory is that it's because of American cultural dominance and the fact that the new proposed American identity is so intrinsically linked to a sense of guilt for the enslavement of Africans and the quasi Marxist sense that they're going to rise up and inherit America. And this sort of narrative is so hallowed within the sort of, the mythology of the new America, and Britain being now essentially a colony or at least a vassal state of America. It is necessary for Britain's new mythos to be fully integrated with this American one. And that's why they want to focus on sub-Saharan Africans rather than any of the other immigrants that are here in huge numbers that ought not to be. But it could be something else. I don't know. But I just wonder, why is it always blacks? But yeah, they
even the race mixing adverts on TV and the billboards and all that, it's always a white woman, usually with a black guy. Yeah. And you do see other combinations, but that's by far the most common that you see.
Massively overrepresented, massively. Very strange. But yeah, this year there was the big hurrah after Drupka Kunli on Twitter posted the clip from Horrible Histories of their it's a children's program, and they misrepresented a whole different load of things from British history. The song was called "Been Here from the Start," and I made a video on debunking it all. But the actual video came out like a couple of years ago, but it didn't really get like a big reaction from anyone until this year. And it's funny because I think the mainstream media actually did a sort of like, you know, faux outrage video articles about that Horrible History thing before it was released. So obviously Horrible History sent the press release, and then they got like, you know, they wanted the faux outrage maybe to help promote it, but nobody actually did any articles or breakdowns on it after it came out. And I never saw it. I remember reading the article and I'm thinking, bloody BBC, bloody blah, blah, and then forgetting about it. And 2 years later, I actually saw it on Twitter. And at first I thought it was AI and that Drukberg made it as like a joke to like parody BBC. But no, it's real. It's real. And it had some of the old, you know, left-wing anti-white canards, like Cheddar Man's black, obviously he's not related to blacks in any way. Septimius Severus is black, doesn't have an ounce of black blood, and some other things as well that were just nonsense. So I debunked that. It was a big thing this year because in September that was like what everyone was talking about, but technically it wasn't something that happened this year. But that's an interesting thing. It can take a couple of years for the people for it to really cotton on how crazy some of these things are, and then you get a real reaction. And then
before you get onto that, what surprised me about that was people were going mad about it, this awful song and all that, but nobody, it took ages for someone to point out, well, Horrible Histories have a history of doing this kind of thing. And I think it was 10 years ago now, they did the British Things song, which with Queen Victoria saying that all these things that we think are British are actually from elsewhere. And that was ages ago.
Well, the actual maker of Horrible Histories, the old man, is an avowed Marxist. And the function of the original Horrible Histories books is to communicate Marxist values to subvert British history. And what surprised me is how many people commenting on my video saying, God, Fall, it used to be damn good, Horrible Histories. And I was thinking, no, it didn't. It was always crap, really. I mean, it wasn't overtly anti-white, because the Marxists weren't so much interested in anti-white stuff in the 90s. They were just, you know, anti-elitism or anti, you know, they were fighting a class war. So, but they turned their class war to become a racial war, and more recently, of course. Yeah, I don't know about that specific example you said, but I mean, I'm not surprised because it is. I mean, he is an avowed Marxist. So.
Well, I'm just wondering if I could find it and play it here, but I don't know if that would be a copyright infringement. It's on YouTube.
Who checks copyright on Odyssey? Are you streaming on Twitter as well?
Yeah, hold on a second. I'll download it and I'll play it. This was from at least 12 years ago that it was uploaded on this YouTube channel. So it's from a long time ago. And it's just disgusting. Hold on a second. I'll see if I can get this. And I'll play this for you. So I think it's important to show this is the climate. You know, and I don't think this is, I mean, this is a very popular, well-regarded TV show. I think this is from about 2010.
For children.
For children.
It's for children. This is to instruct children about our history.
Yeah. Okay, here we go.
I love to be a British queen. I am Victoria, you see. Now where's my British butler with my British cup of tea?
Tea is not from Britain, ma'am, from India it was brought. Yes, for your cup a thousands died and many wars were fought.
British things, my British things, it seems that tea is not. British things, my British things.
Can I sweeten it a jot?
Do tell me sugar's British though.
No, it's Caribbean imported. For sugar in your cup of tea, slavery's been supported. I know it's wrong, Your Majesty, but slaves in Africa worked hard in fields of sugar cane to sweeten up your char.
British things, our British things. I thought that there were many British things, our British things.
Afraid there's hardly any. You know your British cotton vest.
What's wrong with it? Explain.
The cotton's from America and picked by
slaves again.
Your empire's built on fighting wars, that's how your income's swollen. Your British things are from abroad and most are frankly stolen.
Whatever next? Go on, pray tell.
Our British queen is foreign as well.
It's true, I am of foreign descent.
And your husband, Albert?
A German gent. At least I've got a British name.
Victoria's Latin.
That's a shame!
British things, British things.
There are none, we declare.
All our favourite British things
seem to come from elsewhere.
More sugar.
That really, really annoyed me. I mean, look, I just want to get say some things. Like, cotton comes from doesn't come from America. It comes from India. We took it from India. The British took it from India to America. Tea doesn't come from India. It comes from China. We took it from China to India. We did that. We made that industry. We made those things profitable. And that wasn't anything to do with ingenuity of Indians or African slaves. And they're they make those things become Indian by being in India, but they don't become British by being in Britain. It doesn't have any consistency. Just
yeah, but there's any interest in consistency or in being fair. It's just supposed to be poison.
It's just meant to be anti-British. It's just meant to undermine Britishness. But yeah, that's because he's a Marxist. Yeah, of course. Or I don't even know if the original creator of the books is involved in that program. Or to what extent he is, but what difference does it make anyway?
Well, it's some other Marxist who's doing it.
Yeah. They all hate Britain and they want to undermine it. Yeah, that really upset me. I wish I'd never seen that.
I'm sorry, but everyone was going on about this one. I mean, I could play that as well, but the one that we were talking about was a black guy, as you say, released last year, but the fury was this year. The black guy singing about how Britain has always been black. There are always been black people here, right back to...
And then
to...
gave a list of people who aren't black. Like, yeah. that was the really fucking thing, like, really stupid fucking thing about it is that, like, the first black actually correctly identified black person he mentions is in the Tudor times, and it's just a trumpeter. It's just, like, of no consequence whatsoever if he existed or not. It makes absolutely no difference to British history. It's just, like, one trumpeter called John Blanc. And I think that name is even a piss take as well, because Blanc means white.
I don't know how many times I've seen people on Twitter, some idiot lefty liberal saying, you should check your history. There are black Romans in Britain. And it's
read
just,
a book.
Yeah. Read a book. It's not my job to educate you. This kind of thing. And yeah, it's just percolated down. And it happened with Cheddar Man. It's, I don't know how many times, even now, like this year alone, I've seen some idiot saying, have you not heard about Cheddar Man? And then they think they're more educated than you and more informed than you because they've mentioned Cheddar Man and you didn't. So they think you don't know about it. Oh, God, it's infuriating.
I saw a really good comment about this. That phenomenon you describe, it's like the leftist religion, the point of it is that it gives you like many religions do, a feeling of moral superiority, which is usually unmerited. And those are the people who among whom it's unmerited are those who most desire to have such a feeling. And they don't have to actually do the work to understand the subject. They only have to have, you know, the headline from leftist paper that they can use to, you know, like, I mean, the way that Adam Rutherford titled his book, How to Argue with a Racist, like, it's like, I've done the hard work of studying DNA to condense it into these like talking points that you can use to feel superior to people with opposing political views. But that's the actual basis of it. Like, it isn't, that explains why they always make these, like, you know, these points that they're not able to substantiate, and they don't understand them anyway. So almost point debunking them to them, and you explain to them why they're wrong. They don't understand. They're not intelligent enough to even understand how they're wrong. They only know how to parrot things they see on television.
Yeah, but it does work. That's the thing. They don't understand, and it's very clear very soon when you engage one of these people. It's clear that they don't understand. They don't know it. They've just heard this and embraced it, and now they parrot it. And the annoying thing is it takes a long time to disprove what they're saying. They can say it very, very easily, black Romans in Britain, and then you... And then you've got to tediously. So I don't know.
But the anon accounts can deal with them.
Yeah, exactly. My increasingly, I just insult them and then leave. That's the best. Or I retweet it so that other people see it and they answer it.
Anon accounts were made for this: that no man must argue with a midwit.
Yeah, it's insufferable. More recently there was the thing about the plague that was plague. Especially bad to black people.
That was really interesting because in October I decided to do another debunking video where I just for Black History Month, where I went through a bunch of like things from the last 5-10 years where people had called people great Black Britons or tried to make claims that certain people were Black who had subsequently either been proven not to be Black or who were probably not Black, but there's no evidence that were Black and they claim that in the first place, or who were never even, there was never evidence they were Black in the first place. These kind of things. I've got like 8 good examples where they definitely weren't Black. And one of the people involved in one of those studies who making these claims was this Dr. Rebecca Redfern. And those claims, I'd actually emailed her back in like 2015 and had like back and forth with her to try and talk about that. And I never got a solid answer. I thought I'd bring her up again in October, even though she was old news. But then she was back in the news in the following month. In November, she was involved in the study where she said that the plague was the main thing was that the plague was racism during the plague in medieval England because the black victims were disproportionately affected by it. But of course, underlying that is not only the fact that that's not true, it's also the fact that they didn't actually find any conclusively black victims, a single one. So when I had to debunk that, when I'm like, okay, like they almost want you to like argue with the fake argument about whether or not the plague was racist. When we actually go to the meat of it, like you haven't found any conclusively black bodies. And she's using the same thing she did in 2014, 2015, when she was looking at Roman bodies and using this macromorphoscopics, which is okay. Like I'm not like some people say, like a lot of like liberal, like classical liberals watching my video saying to her, she's just like a Nazi because she's using skull measurements to try and identify race. I thought that the Nazis would have been debunked already or whatever. Like that isn't true. Actually, there are differences between the skulls of different races. But the problem with the two forms of sciences that use that is like craniometry, where you measure skull dimensions and you get like averages that are give an average for each race. And then the other is macromorphoscopics, which is a long, fancy sounding words for basically not measured, the kind of skull measurements that you can't measure. So just looking at shape of the eye, shape is more like, you know, going by eye, isn't like, so for those things, which is what she does. That's her specialist thing. And DNA is not her specialist thing. She always like, has a little bit of a DNA thing attached to it with the Roman study and this one, like, but the DNA studies are really, really weak and they're not they don't get good results and they're not the focus of the study. They're very like low resolution studies. And they're not, I mean, in 2014, that was fine because that was pretty standard at the time. But now in 2023, that's not what people expect anymore because archaeogenetics has become a really amazing and interesting field, especially like, you know, a lot of there's universities around the world involved in it, but the Max Planck Society in Germany and Harvard University have been two especially leading the way in archaeogenetics. And frankly, this kind of like, you know, half-assed look at maternal haplogroups and then looking at someone's skull and just sort of saying, looks like a black person. It's just not, does not cut it anymore. It's not up to scratch in 2023. And she can use it to say like, okay, these people look black. But she actually says in the paper, I mean, if you watch my video debunking it, if you like the paper even says like, that according to like the dimensions, they're most likely Asian skulls, but we consider it unlikely that they're Asian. And that's probably just because they had slightly different shape size skulls in those days. So, but yeah, this one's probably black. like what? They're even saying like, they don't want it to be Asian for some reason, but it's obviously not Asian. Like they literally said like, sometimes they have slightly wider cheekbones. So that would get a false positive for Asian. You get false positives all the time. I don't just argue with lefties about this. Like, some Americans got annoyed with me when I said, like, there's a skull that was found, a Native American skull called Kennewick Man years ago. And based on like craniometry and macromorphoscopics, it kind of looks like a white guy's skull or maybe an Australian skull, an Australoid skull. But it's not an Abbo and it's not a white guy. It's a Native American. They did a DNA test on it. We know it's a Native American. So everyone like said, okay, that was... It looked white. It was reasonable to think it was white, but it isn't. But because skulls aren't like 100% reliable for identifying an individual's race. Like certainly if I had like 10 people's skulls and then I got averages from them and they're all from one population, then you could definitely say based on that, you get quite confident, you know, averages. But one, because there's so much like individual differences, like it's not really reliable. And like, I think, it's much more useful when you're using it in the context, like saying, okay, we found these skulls in the middle of the jungle in Africa. Most of them look African. This one kind of doesn't, but it probably is African because it's in Africa. Then it's fine. But if you start like taking this, you know, what Morgoth used to call it, like the hatchling approach, like, oh, it could be any race, couldn't it? It's from Roman Britain. It could be any race in the world. Like, obviously, that's
it's the equivalent of... Well, but did Tolkien specifically say that this character wasn't black?
Did he say he wasn't a tranny? I don't recall that line. But this kind of stuff is completely dishonest. And this woman is like, you know, look at her, all the stuff she's worked on. She's a white woman living in London, works for the Museum of London, and museums know about where they're getting their funding, and this gets public money involved in the Museum of London, so there's pressure to make sure that they're doing this kind of thing. We saw a similar thing back in Sweden with a museum, like this, a curator of a museum was interpreting some Islamic Viking embroidery and saying, oh, it's actually Arabic script. And then the experts on Arabic script were like, no, it's not. It's not, definitely isn't. But like, because she knew she could get a lot of attention for their little museum if she made up this, you know, diversity bullshit. Something's going on here with Rebecca Redfern. And also she probably has some kind of personal interest in that sort of thing as well. But it's not necessarily like she wants to destroy, you know, she's like wants to genocide white people or anything. It's probably just she's completely immersed in that like worldview of liberal Londoners. And there's also a financial incentive and a you know, career incentive to keep pushing towards stuff that people are, like there's certain powerful bodies that want that sort of stuff to be produced. And she knows also this time I couldn't actually debunk the original paper. So I had to go back and debunk a former paper that she'd done, which was involved in the study, and infer what was in the new study based on it, because the new paper, the whole articles were all about wasn't published. She, before the article comes out, she gave a press release to the BBC and the Guardian were doing a news article on on a paper that nobody's read. Nobody can actually check on it and tell them if the if its methodology is reliable or anything like that. So I thought that was really annoying. But
I might be wrong, but I seem to recall a similar thing happening with the Cheddar Man announcement, where it was a press release, like a press conference first, and then the study. I might be wrong, but
well, maybe with the reconstruction, the model. Like I think that might have been announcing, but that's a bit different because, to be fair, the complexion of Cheddar Man was not a great as big a deal as people thought it was, because as I said previously, Cheddar Man belonged to a race of people who lived all across Europe, and Cheddar Man is not the first person of that race to be analyzed. And I was saying years before Cheddar Man's DNA was analyzed that that race probably had darker skin than modern Europeans do, because it was already well known for studies in Luxembourg and studies in Spain on the same race. That race is only related to Europeans. It is not related to any other modern race. It is a Europoid race that doesn't exist anymore, but is related to modern Europeans. And it may have had darker skin. That's what the DNA evidence seems to show, but it's hard to tell because we don't know how exactly the genes. It's very complicated how complexion is manifested, because, for example, the genes that make us have light skin are absent in Koreans who also have light skin. So it doesn't mean that because you don't have those genes, those that you won't have this trait. So it's a very complicated topic. It just seems probable. It's probable that that race had darker skin than modern Europeans, but not certain. And the main problem I had was Afua Hirsch did an article back in 2018 for the National Geographic, was once a reputable magazine, and she described them as Africans. And even the Natural History Museum, when interviewed about it, and Tom Booth from the Natural History Museum was the one responsible for that Cheddar Man thing, they said, "Are they African?" He goes, "No, they're not African. They weren't African. It was the media who was trying to push that by saying they were black and using ambiguity around the word black." But then Afua Hirsch, being an idiot, actually just went and said, used the word African. And then the weird thing is the National Geographic published that, and nobody like Adam Rutherford and all these BBC talking head DNA people were happy to come tweet at me in 2018 and tell me I was wrong about some minute thing. But no one fucking told Afua Hirsch that she just made up that he was African. They didn't care. They didn't care it was in National Geographic. It's like they don't give a shit about the truth. They just want to make people think that British people don't have any right to this land. They want to make us think we have no ancestral rights. No, none of the things that they advocate for so-called indigenous peoples all over the world, but not for us. They just don't want us to have those. So they're trying to undermine narratives of belonging among the natives.
And here the method is so fatuous. I mean, what they're saying is that Cheddar Man had dark, he wasn't African, but he had dark skin, therefore, that's really it. That's really the extent of the depth that's of it. The argument. It's absolutely pathetic, childish, so childish. Yeah. And
it's like saying, some Africans are albinos, therefore the colonization of Africa was justified. It doesn't make any sense. It's like, it's a completely retarded argument. Like, it shouldn't be, no one should be allowed to speak in public who would make such an argument. It's so utterly asinine.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know, you could despair. I mean, these are the pillars of our society in academia and the media and in the science sector. Because that's the other thing, the guy who led the Cheddar Man team had previously said, a year before or something, that science should be trying to undermine nationalism.
Yeah, Tom Booth said that in response to Brexit. He said that we need to prevent these narratives that the far right use. He explicitly said that in 2017 in a paper co-published with Natural History Museum and UCL.
Incredible. I do have a few super chats for you. People always enjoy your appearances on Millennial, so thank you for doing this.
My pleasure.
Okay. Well, is there anything else that you would want to bring up from this year before we do that?
Not especially. I can just give some white pills. I can say I've had 73% more subscribers than I did in 2022, and 30% more watch time, and 31% more views than 2022. So it's been a better year for me than 2022, which wasn't a great year in terms of my channel. So that's good. And hopefully onwards and upwards.
Oh, yeah. Well, congratulations. And yes, I hope that continues. These are all mostly from Black Pigeon Pilled. He says, my brothers wish for me to get them a DNA kit. Which one would STJ most recommend for a reasonable price? DNA kits.
DNA, that commercial DNA testing. I'm assuming that your brother is of entirely European ancestry. The thing is, people are afraid of the big ones because they think they're going to do something funny with their DNA. You choose what access they have in the settings. Go there and the privacy settings there. Say, I don't want you to keep my DNA. I don't want you to share my DNA. You untick those boxes. If you don't untick them, they can do that stuff. There's not much that they would be able to do to hurt you with it anyway. So I wouldn't really worry as much as, I mean, they could use it to make money. The worst they could do is like sell your data and then like they make money on it and you've paid for it, which is illegal because it's, you know. But anyway, there's nothing going to happen. Like, they're not going to be able to clone you because they're only taking a little tiny bit of your DNA to tell your ancestry. It's not a big deal. It really depends what you want to get, because some provide your autosomal DNA, which shows your ancestry for the last eight generations, and the haplogroup, and your haplogroups, like your paternal and maternal deep lineages, which are really interesting. Although they're only a tiny amount of your DNA, they don't tell much about who you are. They tell you a lot about your deep ancestry and ancestors long ago. Some of them don't provide that. And some of them provide health reports, which are, I got no idea how accurate those are. I'm not well read on like medical genetics. Like that's not my area. But they're interesting. Some of them don't provide that. In terms of the main ones are 23andMe and Ancestry.com and MyHeritage. I'd say Ancestry and 23andMe are fine for anyone of predominantly European ancestry. If you have non-European ancestry, then if you want detailed sub breakdown of Southeast Asia or South Asia, like it might be that there are other companies that specialize in that, because the majority of 23andMe and Ancestry.com's clients are of Northwest European heritage and Jewish heritage. They both heavily oversample Ashkenazi Jews and also people from the British Isles, the people who buy these tests in America are like. They're all mostly people of Northwest European or Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry. If you want to know a really good breakdown of your sub-regional ancestry in the British Isles and you're of mostly British descent, then use Living DNA, because they give a very good breakdown of, like, they can say Devon, Somerset, Dorset. They can break it down by county in a way that 23andMe and Ancestry.com don't. But if you're not mostly from British Isles ancestry, then you probably don't want to use them, because their sampling is very heavy focused on the British Isles.
All right. I was just going to look at my 23andMe results, because I know they changed them. They update it with new data about every 6 months. But it's been a while since I last looked at it.
I don't think they've updated it this year. Not sure. Mm-hmm. 23andMe, the problem is that they put British and Irish into one category, and then they put English and they include England and Northwest. No, that's not Ancestry did that. They put France and Germany in one category.
Germany and France, they put together. This is a weird.
Those are distinguishable. So Ireland and Britain is also distinguishable, but it's a bit complicated because there's always an overlapping region. But the overlapping region for Ireland and Britain is southwestern Scotland and Northern Ireland. The rest of them don't overlap. But there's also overlap. England overlaps with Belgium and Holland as well. But they're happy to keep those separate. And France and Germany do overlap a bit because they share a border, but most of them don't. So they've chosen to kind of lump those together. I don't know why they've made that decision. But Ancestry lumps them, Ancestry.com lumps as well, but different lumps. It has this category called England and Northwestern Europe. But their definition of Northwestern Europe is just Belgium. It's just Belgium. Who refers to Belgium as Northwestern Europe? Obviously, Ireland is in Northwestern Europe. Obviously, Holland and France is stupid. The categories are stupid. And sometimes their descriptions of the ancestry are stupid too. But yeah, the actual, they're not in, as inaccurate as some people think. Like, they're pretty accurate, especially if you're from Northwestern Europe.
Yeah, I'll just put mine up. This is from 2017 or 2017. So that's mine, and it's pretty good actually.
I would say it's what I if you'd like me to interpret it, knowing that you're an Italian Scot.
Quarter the Iberian, Italian.
Yeah, the Iberian is a mistake. That's just Italian. It's just they've mixed it up somehow. So all that Southern European, that 7% should all be considered Italian and ignore that it says 2% Iberian. And the French and German is also a mistake. It's just English. But they just, they often, they, I have as, according to 23andMe, I have like as much French and German as I do British and Irish. But then I do other companies and I have no French and German. So it's obvious that this is just the continental ancestry from the Anglo-Saxons. Is sometimes classed as British and Irish and sometimes as French and German, and they don't properly distinguish it. So that French and German is just English, basically, and they just messed it up.
In which case, I'm 90.2% British.
Yeah, that would be about, I'd say that is about right. But that, some of that could be like Scandinavian Viking, but that's all British as well, really, isn't it? Because it's been here for 1,000 years. So yeah, 90% British and 7% Italian is probably what this means.
Yeah. Oh, that's good news. Thank you. And then that's another summary that doesn't really matter. I think there was another one, but I'm struggling to see it now. This was this one.
Oh, yeah. I had that for a while, and then it went away again. They put it there, and then they took it away. The Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away.
All right. Okay, and then the next one. This is Black Pigeon Pilled again. I am interested in STJ's ongoing research into, and I don't know if this is a racist term or not. I'm just going to read out what is there. His ongoing research into Darkie Devon. Where does he recommend I obtain my own hardback copy? Hope he gets the reference. Merry Christmas, Yule, to you both. Do you have any idea what this is about?
Darkie Devon. I don't know exactly what he means, to be honest. I can think of a couple of things he could mean, but I'm not sure if I want to answer without knowing for sure. So I give him a chance to elaborate. He could refer to, like, he might be referring to a trait that's, there are some folks in the southwest of England who are slightly darker than the average British person. And that's an interesting phenotype. I haven't actually done any research on it. I think that's a joke. But like, I do think it would be... Like, sometimes you can see some native British people from the southwest who are... They don't look like... They look completely British. They look completely British, but they just have much darker skin than you'd expect a British person to have. So it's quite interesting. And I sometimes think that I should do a photo album. I should take my camera and photograph them and make it like a little photo blog of this phenotype. Because I think because the lightest complexion in the world is from the British Isles, it's associated with Northwestern Europe, Northwestern Ireland, sorry, Northern Ireland. And British people have some of the lightest skin in the world. Some people don't realize that also there are some British people who have quite dark complexions. There's a huge variety of natural complexions among people from the British Isles.
Think there's an actor called Jack Shepherd who was in a very boring 90s detective program called Wycliffe, which I think was set in Devon sort of area. And this is him here. Of course, this photo doesn't show, but I think he's got rather dark skin for an Englishman.
You can find people even darker than that. Yeah, but yeah, he is quite dark. But yeah, there are some, yeah, slightly dark complexion, especially in Cornwall, less so in Devon. But yeah, but it's not like, I mean, they're as dark as a Spanish person, maybe, or something like that. But they don't look like Spanish people. They look like English people with darker skin. But yeah.
All right. Well, I'm presuming that's what he was referring to.
Maybe. I don't know.
Okay. But I don't think he would use a racist term. I think he's a sensible guy. Okay. And who does STJ consider the most the most based living academic? Apart from yourself, obviously.
Oh, I don't know. I can't. Sorry, I'm too tired to think of about that. But yeah, I don't know. Can I pass that one?
Okay. All right. And let's see. What relationship does STJ think esotericism has with paganism, both in scholarship and amongst practitioners? The relationship between paganism and esotericism.
Interesting. Okay, so every religion has, or nearly every religion has had an esoteric dimension, which is usually the preserve of an elite and isn't to be shared with everybody. And the general functioning of a religion is exoteric, that it doesn't rely on esotericism for people to understand it and practice it. Exoteric is the general practice. And pagan religions are no different. Some of the mystery cults in Rome are exclusively esoteric in the sense that they are like you cannot access them without the esoteric knowledge, but those weren't the normal Roman religion. Like the normal Roman religion, for example, you didn't need any esoteric knowledge. You just made the sacrifices. But like the mystery cults, as they're called, were esoteric. And with the exception of Christianity, which is a mystery cult without, which was open to anyone. Whereas like others, like the Eleusinian mysteries, you had to be initiated into it and you weren't allowed to talk about any of the Eleusinian mysteries. The Western esoteric tradition that has emerged, that we have now, comes from Hermeticism and also to some extent Kabbalah, Jewish Kabbalah, which is that Jewish esoteric tradition, but those both have origins to some extent, varying extents, in Neoplatonism, which is esoteric, and the esoteric aspects of that were mostly because it's too complicated for the average person to understand. But yes, that's pagan. So in a sense, even Western esotericism today, which isn't technically pagan, is derived from paganism. And Western esotericism has it's mostly like being passed on to us through Christianity and Judaism now, but has origins that predate either and are in pagan in many cases. But yeah, esotericism is a very interesting topic, but it's not an essential part of any religion. It's just, it isn't an essential part of religion for every practitioner. But like even Christianity there's esoteric Christianity and things like that. There's esoteric Islam
Sufism.
Yeah, the Sufism. As you know well, you're well very familiar with the Sufi practice.
Yes, tonight. Yes, indeed. All right. Stan says, really like the train intro. Keep up the good work. Well, thank you very much. And then again, Black Pigeon Pilled. Does STJ think that the term Aryan has any substantive meaning? And does he envisage the possibility of the term entering wider usage again?
I think it's really a useful term to refer to the people who actually did first people to use it. So I've made a post on Telegram about this. Like the term Aryan it was reconstructed because it exists in the Iranic and in the Indic languages. And therefore, we know that it was spoken by and used as an ethnonym by the mutual ancestors of the Iranic and Indic people on the Central Asian steppe, who were referred to as the Aryans for a long time. And I still think they should be referred to as the Aryans. The problem is that because people thought that Sanskrit was the most archaic Indo-European language, it was believed in the 19th century that that was probably the homeland of all Indo-European languages. And therefore, there wasn't a distinction made between the Proto-Indo-Iranians and the Proto-Indo-Europeans. And so the Proto-Indo-Europeans were referred to as the Aryans. And since they theorized, actually quite correctly, that these people living in the Central Asian steppe at that time were of a Nordic European type, they thought, therefore, that the Proto-Indo-Europeans were of a Nordic Indo-European type and were referred to themselves as Aryans. But that's not true. They didn't. And they weren't especially Nordic type either. The Proto-Indo-Europeans lived 1,000 years or more before the Proto-Indo-Iranians. And the Proto-Indo-Iranians lived on the Central Asian steppe and had a sort of Nordic-esque appearance with blonde hair and blue eyes. But the Proto-Indo-Europeans living 1,000 years earlier lived in Ukraine and South Russia. And they didn't have, they had darker hair, but sometimes had ginger hair, but usually had their dark hair and brown eyes. And they didn't refer to themselves as Aryans. So I don't think it's appropriate to refer to Proto-Indo-Europeans as Aryans. I disagree with Bap on that. I explained to him why I didn't think it was a good idea to refer to them that way anymore, because it's confusing as well. Because culturally, temporally, geographically, the Proto-Indo-Iranians and the Proto-Indo-Europeans are distinct enough that you need two different terms for them. Linguists use Proto-Indo-European and Proto-Indo-Iranian. Archaeologists refer to the latter as the Andronovo and Sintashta culture, and the former as the Yamnaya and Corded Ware cultures. But what's like a colloquial term for them? There isn't one. Western steppe geneticists call Western steppe herders, but I think the term Aryan is still appropriate for the Andronovo people, because we know for a fact that that's what they called themselves. They definitely did call themselves Aryans. And so why not call them Aryans? Like, that's fine. But it should be very clear that the Aryans are not the ancestors of the Europeans. They are a group of Europeans who moved to Asia. And then they became the ancestors of the Indians and the Iranians. And that's the problem I have. I don't think you should refer to white people today as the Aryans, like neo-Nazis do. It's confusing. And I don't think we should refer to the Proto-Indo-Europeans as Aryans. But I think it's okay to refer to Proto-Indo-Iranians as Aryans.
All right. I thought of a joke, but I'm not sure whether to say it. I don't think it would be... No, I won't say it. Okay. All right, it's just a pun.
Tell me after.
I'll tell you afterwards, and you can say, oh, you should have said that on air. It would have been hilarious. All right. Okay, there was one from... someone said... Oh, yeah, the punk metal pipe. Okay. Right. This is from Insightful World. Is there a punk metal pipeline to heathenism, nationalism? I see it more and more recently. I do say this with my tongue in my cheek, but is it possible that there is a genetic predisposition to this?
Well, I don't know, but I tell you what, like, there's different types of punk and metal, aren't there? Like, there's a lot of like people in punk and metal who had like people who were crusties or have their dreadlocks and stuff and like left wing stuff, don't they? And like people like emo, often quite effeminate, maybe, but like certain type of punk and metal people who like to put on boots and get and fight in a mosh pit and shave their heads. I think like the hyper masculine, I can imagine like there's a connection there to like right wing beliefs. And of course, if you stumble upon the actual right wing metal and right wing punk bands, then that they can be influential on some people.
I'm just thinking of Aureus Press always putting up these photos of metal bands, especially what was his name, Lemmy. He just put up one today of that. He's clearly quite obsessed with that kind of thing.
Yeah, I have a big disagreement with him because he's very anti-punk. But I point out that there's way more right-wing punk bands than right-wing metal.
He wouldn't like that.
I have arguments with him about it. Yeah, he's very anti. He's very thinks metal is metal rules, punk sucks. Car park fight thing.
All right. Well, okay. Can you name the large megafauna extinct animals that our last Ice Age ancestors had to hunt, roam, and survive from in 30,000-year-old Ice Age Britain? That time period has always fascinated me as a small boy. I grew up on BBC Walking with Beasts as a Zoomer. The large megafauna extinct animals that our ancestors hunted.
If he watched those things and he's fascinated by the topic, then I'm sure he already knows them. But yeah, Britain didn't exist 30,000 years ago as a distinct geographic mark. It was connected to the continent. So whatever you know, there's no point referring to the animals of Britain because it's just Europe. So or West Eurasia. Yeah, you've got woolly mammoth, woolly rhinos, cave hyenas, cave bears, wisent, which is like what they call buffalo in America, or we call bison, or I guess the wisent. Lions lived in Europe in those times. Eurasian lions. Those aren't necessarily megafauna. The megaloceros, which is also known as the Irish elk. I don't know why it's called the Irish elk, but in that photo you can see the wild horses. There were wild horses, wild horses, and also you can see there's a muskox, I believe. And
I think it is, on the left there, yeah.
Yeah, muskox. So you had huge herds of animals. The idea that Europe was all forest at that time is wrong. It wasn't. The north was all glaciers, and the south had large enough plains. The mammoth, that's a wisent, yeah? Or is it an American buffalo? They look the same anyway. There are herds of wisent in Poland in the forest, but they didn't live naturally in the forest. They only survived in the forest because that's all the only place they can live. But they lived exactly the same as in North America, on huge plains, and that they would vast herds of large beasts like wisent and horses and even mammoth. And the population of Europe of humans in Europe was very small. It was dominated by animals, not by humans.
All right. Okay, there's one more. It's quite cuddly.
Is that a muskox? Right. Yeah, muskox, yeah.
All right, and let me see the super chats have disappeared. Bugger. That's worrying. I'll refresh the page. Right, okay, thank God. Someone says, congratulations on the continued success. I felt a genuine sense of hope at how far-reaching and well-received your recent videos debunking mainstream narratives were. Cheers to you both. Thank you very much. Bob's Vegana says, could you recommend an introductory book to get me started in Norse paganism?
Well, I'll tell you what, like, if you want to start practicing, instead of a book, if you want to learn about Norse paganism as a historical topic, I think Gods and Myths of the Northmen by Hilda Ellis Davidson is pretty good. But if you want to start practicing, I think most books don't really talk about practice. That most of the books that introduce you to heathenry are all about like mythology and interpreting mythology, which then you can read them and then you can debate in your own mind whether that's right or wrong. But the actual, what do I do to actually start practicing? They're not very practical, surprisingly. I'm going to make a course, a proper e-learning, distance learning course, where you'll be able to go through about 11 lessons. And by the end of it, you'll know exactly how to practice. And I think that'll be better than any book that you can possibly buy.
Excellent. Okay. Dominic asks, do you know if the peoples of Far East Siberia migrated over to Alaska, Canada in ancient times?
Yes, the Beringian Strait is where Native Americans entered into America.
Yeah, yeah, I think, even I knew that. Maybe it had been in doubt at some point.
It's been, well, it's been proven. It's always been a little bit like how, because the ice sheet was very big and far down then, so they couldn't have walked, but they must have skirted along the ice sheet, basically hunting seals or something like that, and then found themselves in America.
Right, okay. Just wanted to thank Tom for all he does and for putting me on the path to being a good pagan. May the gods grant him the strength and resolve to keep on surviving the jive. That's from Burnsy. Very nice. Max says, I think spirituality is an important front to preserve and stoke the fires of the British people so that they understand their pagan past. So maybe we can get something like Carl Jung said with the rise of Wotan.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that was really interesting that, like, the Jungian perspective, like heathens, like the big voices in heathenry and like thinking people who like pushing things forward in heathenry 10, 15 years ago were very much influenced by Jung and his idea of archetypes. So Stephen McNallan, Richard Rudgley, many others were focusing on this because it was very interesting about the idea that the gods themselves were latent forces waiting to reemerge by their own volition. And I think that was true. But also, there's a limit to how useful Jung is for helping you to understand pre-Christian religions. But I think it's true.
Okay. The admission, this is from Dino Legovic. The admission of the term Eurocentrism into the lexicon, coined by a Marxist involved with Cambodia and its horrors, has been bashing white men for decades. Tell these scum to F right off. The term Eurocentrism. Do you have anything to say about that?
I don't know. Usually when people say stuff like that, it's like, I don't know what he's talking about exactly.
Apparently, the term was invented by Samir Amin, who's an Egyptian. I didn't know that.
When people say when people say Nordicism, they're always like tilting at windmills. It's like this made up thing. Like they just think that it's like insecurity of some kind. They should use that term. There's usually nothing behind it. Like. When people like concerned that there's some Eurocentric agenda or something, there's nothing there.
Yes. Okay. Oh yeah. That question. Yeah. That we already asked that one. Okay. Thin red line. The jive, survive the jive. Germanics probably said something like Harian, as in German, here, army, Herr, sir or Lord, Herrlich, wonderful. Harry est Teva, one of the oldest Germanic inscriptions. There we go. I don't know what that means. Are the Maltese a Semitic people? There's a lot of mystery to that island. The Maltese.
Are the Maltese what? Egyptian?
Semitic.
Semitic. Okay. Malta has its own language. Which I think is influenced by Semitic languages, like Arabic mainly, it's influenced by Arabic. As a genetic group, they are exactly as you expect they are geographically. They're in between Italians and North Africans. They've had Semitic people, Arabs, living there, the Moors, but they've also had lots of the Normans there, and they've had Italians, so they're a mixed-up bunch. And there was a clever relative of mine who was involved in the Rousall-Keenan Commission to try and make English the main language on that island, which was a good idea, probably. But no, it was to try and undermine Italian cultural dominance on the island. That was the reason for it. But then also another relative of mine, who was not a Rousall, but Walter Congreve, was also the governor of Malta. So I've never been there, but yeah, I can tell you that they have a language with Semitic influence. I'm not sure if it's classed as Semitic or not, the Maltese language. You could probably just Google that.
I didn't even know that they had their own language. But I just looked, and apparently there are 500,000. The population of Malta is 520,000. So
it is a Semitic language. I just checked. It's a Semitic.
Right.
It's derived from Arabic, basically. Yeah.
Right.
But they also speak Italian.
Okay.
Unfortunately, it was tried. We tried. The Rausals tried to stop that, but it failed.
Okay. All right. Only one more super chat. This is from Denise Angrad Celtic. Hello, Denise. Bless you, Tom Rausel. As a pagan, I find that alleged white advocates are stuck in the death. She makes an anti-Christian comment there, and are too lazy to research the authentic beliefs of our people. That course sounds terrific. May the Dagda bless and keep you for all your days. Thank you, Denise. She's quite quite assertive, quite opinionated. Is our Denise, and she has Dagda's very
Irish. She must be Irish.
I would say so. Yes. Fiery Celtic passion.
Yeah, very much. She got a fist up. Fist up to the Christian thing. It's not exactly. normally something that Irish people say, but yeah.
But yes, thank you very much for that contribution, Denise.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
There's one more. Did STJ enjoy his trip to Greece? Sorry to hear he was pickpocketed. On the subject of Greece, does he feel Britain should return the Elgin marbles?
Okay, well, he knew I was pickpocketed. But the pickpocketing video that I made is mostly me explaining exactly what the Elgin marble situation is. So he obviously didn't watch the video. He only looked at the title of it. But if you want to know my opinion on the Elgin marbles, which is a nuance, and I don't want to just give a quick thing. I think you should watch that video called Pickpocketed in Greece, because it's just me hiking up to the Parthenon, and I was pickpocketed on the way up because I was so busy talking about the Elgin marbles. I'm sympathetic to the Greek desire to have them back, but there's a bit more nuance to just saying we should give them back. It's not that simple.
Okay. Someone's annoyed with me for not reading out Denise's full super chat. Listen, she's got her own way of saying things. I don't want to read out something that could offend half of my listeners, all right? So I've got to be diplomatic about this kind of thing. And then John Selmer says, return the Elgin marbles to the Ivory Coast. that's his opinion. Okay. And Nick says, he's talking to me. I'm glad you've added an MP3 download option so that I can download and listen at work without any faff. Well, that's been there all along. I'm sorry if I didn't publicize it well enough. Also, it has got to be a priority to have a standard payment system for funding ne'er-do-wells. Definitely a UK one. For example, buy me a kebab. Very good, Nick. Thank you very much. All right. I think that's all of them. So, yes. Well, thanks very much. That's lots of super chats there. As I said, you're always hotly anticipated and well received on Millennial. So thank you for agreeing to appear again.
Yeah. Thank you for having me again.
Yes. And, all right.
All the best with the rest of Millennial. Have good yule to all your listeners on the Millennial Express. Choo choo. May it continue.
Yes.
Long may it go on. And congratulations on 9 years.
Oh, thank you very much. It's been a long journey, but we're still going strong. So, all right, excellent. Well, I'll be back in half an hour. It's nice to have a break between the streams. That hasn't happened often enough this year. But I'll be back in half an hour. And in the meantime, survive the jive. Thank you for appearing on Millennial 2023.
Good night, everyone, and thank you for watching.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. Sometimes the old ways are the best, To send Millennial Woes some special Yuletide cheer by post, you can use the P.O. Box. Address on screen now. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word.